do you know the difference between marketing and branding? There is one, and it's very important to understand and implement.
This is the Economics for Business podcast. We are here to help all businesses become champions for customers and value, improving lives with preferred and innovative products and services. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. In the Austrian view of the firm, marketing is at the center of operations. Marketing engages with customers, develops an understanding of customers, and brings that understanding inside the company to help shape and guide all the other aspects of the firm's operations. Especially innovation and customer service, of course, but truly all aspects of the firm from the back end to the front end and everything in between. In the great firms, everyone does marketing. It's how a business behaves in its relations with customers. And there's a special aspect of marketing that goes by the name of branding or brand building. It applies to all businesses, B2C and B2B. Branding is especially important in business because it's asset building. Assets are value drivers for customers, the source of their valued experiences, and therefore the source of cash flow for the company. Nike customers experience value as a result of Nike's assets. Its manufacturing and supply chain assets that make great performance footwear, the design assets that ensure distinctivity, style, and best technology incorporation, and the distribution assets for availability and choice, and of course the asset of the Nike brand that makes users feel that unique sense of achievement that pleases them so much. Yes, a brand is an asset. Financial studies show that brands can generate higher, longer, and steadier cash flows, delivering value over time and supporting the customer loyalty that is one of the core properties of the profitable business. We're going to make the case today that marketing in the digital age has lost a lot of its human engagement characteristics. It's become mechanized and mathematical. It's all about the number of views and the number of clicks, and the algorithmic serving of ads and offers that can be invasive and sometimes creepy. You don't want your customers to feel your brand is creepy. And that's the difference between marketing and branding. Branding generates feelings of positive emotional connection, of friendship, or companionship, or even love. A brand is a character to which customers can relate. It can be reliable and trustworthy and supportive and empowering and liberating. That's a powerful business asset to have. Or actually to build over time. Our guest today is a true expert in the field, Grace Ann Bennett. She's a master brand strategist. She's been head of strategy at four major global marketing agencies, shaping such brands as Dove and Volkswagen and Coca-Cola and Four Seasons and the Wall Street Journal. She currently runs Playbook Studio, providing brand consulting, brand design, and brand content strategies. And she's going to share her expertise with us. Grace Ann, welcome to the Economics for Business podcast.
Thank you for having me.
No, it's our pleasure. We're going to discuss brand building today compared to marketing. And We're big enthusiasts of the brand building process. It builds assets that create value for customers, and that's what we're all about. You've had an illustrious career in the branding field. You've been involved and you've influenced and shaped and directed many, many brands. So we're looking forward to your authoritative perspective. Do you want to give a little background just on the kinds of brand activities and marketing activities and you know career things that you've been involved in?
Okay, well, it's, to make it short, I'll do the Reader's Digest version for people old enough to even know that reference, right?
I do.
No, Reader's Digest, these short, snappy
TV guide.
Maybe it's a TikTok, you know, Reels version now. But I mean, I've always been obsessed with brands and the meaning of brands, even all the way back into high school and college. I'd always kind of rebrand everything I was part of to make it, you know, more valuable, also just bring the cool factor in. And I was always watching, you know, why people drove the cars they drove or wore the pair of jeans they wore. And there wasn't really the field of branding per se when I jumped in. I mean, it was the Mad Men era and And I mean, as post Mad Men, but I think they just had people that were account people and the creatives. And so the meaning makers were the creatives and they would be figuring this out. And then when I got to New York City in the late 80s, there was some, you know, in London, people were doing this thing called account planning and this whole idea of branding and figure out the psychology of branding and having that be its own kind of discipline. What came into be. So my first thing is I worked on Pepsi Cola, repositioned Pepsi Cola globally because Coca-Cola had a unified campaign strategy and Pepsi was more regionalized. So I'm in my early 20s going around the world talking to Coke and Pepsi drinkers, trying to figure out kind of what unifies the Pepsi audience and what makes Pepsi desirable, meaningful, and can actually compete against Coca-Cola in the landscape. So that kind of got me started. And then I worked on the Coca-Cola brand right after that. And then I've worked on big brands like Guinness, Volkswagen. That was a fun one because that's had great advertising. The Dove campaign for Real Beauty. And then also worked on repositioning and rebranding my own religion, the Mormon Church, and then wrote the advertising campaign that went globally. So everything from Pepsi Cola to a world religion, and then a million things in between. So I've been doing it my whole life, and I love it. So I love what I do.
Good. Well, you're immersed, certainly. Those are great brands. And let's start with a definition. Grace Anne, because we're going to try and differentiate between branding and marketing. So how do you define brands and branding? And then we'll try to differentiate it from marketing.
Well, brands are the symbol, the kind of they hold this kind of the value and the meaning of that brand and what it means to reach for that brand versus another brand. So I feel like the brand is kind of this psychological value that it has. And it is kind of the codes and the meaning and all that goes into that. Marketing is kind of the mechanics of getting people's attention and just cranking the machine. And there's like numbers, there's a lot of science and algorithms now. And it's about, you know, getting the right attention and kind of converting the sale, finding the people. But it's much more technical. And I don't even think I ever thought there was a difference between branding and marketing when I started. But as we got more sophisticated with the technology and, you know, there was a divide between the performance marketing that had to have the, you know, the ROI, and it was very measurable because before I don't think you could measure that specifically. So now with the measurement tools and their marketing has kind of gone in its own direction. So branding is kind of the art, I find, of building desire and building, you know, some kind of lasting meaning and bigger value, which gives you a disproportionate amount of affinity, or it gives you the benefit of the doubt, helps you be able to raise your prices, attract more people. So it's all those types of things that the brand does. And then the marketing is just the machine that takes what the brand means and that value that you've created and tries to convert it into some quantifiable, tangible action.
Yeah. Yeah, you worked on Coke and Pepsi, another great iconic brands. I worked on Marlboro at one point in time, which I know is distasteful these days because it's cigarette marketing, but I really enjoyed it. And we figured out that Marlboro stood for freedom, adventure, and independence. And mm-hmm. That was our distillation. So as you say, it's highly symbolic. And then we tried to figure out how around the world in different countries, freedom, adventure, and independence would be translated in the way that people choose. And you said something magic there that came to you naturally, Grace Anne. You tried to figure out why people choose the jeans that they wear and the soft drinks that they drink and so on like that. What have you arrived at any deep understanding? Are there standards for understanding why consumers choose what they choose, or does it just vary by context and brand?
Well, I do think one disappointing thing about human nature is that people don't like choice that much. So I think if you really like went, when I went around the world and I thought of the power, I mean, they do like choice and I'm not, but working on Coke and Pepsi and Pepsi had the line, you know, the choice of the next generation, but they were the smaller brand. So when you go, and I was talking to all the people that drink Coca-Cola, they were the football quarterback and just the good looking, popular people that it was the default choice. There was no choice being made. Coca-Cola is what you drink. So I found the Pepsi drinkers far more interesting and I wanted to hang out with them. And the focus groups that we did around the world with the Pepsi drinkers were, they were really interesting people. So I'm more of a choice person and I like taking choice, making choices. And, you know, people obviously do make choices, but I think in a lot of it, thinking about people look for norms and they look for ways to be like other people. And so from a choice standpoint, or even just Jeff Bezos is a genius at kind of becoming a default choice, or Uber, you know, you load it on your phone and you never have to choose again. So I think, and even working on religion, trying to get people to change their religion or thinking about that choice, a lot of it is what you're born into when you're trying to fit in to the certain society or group that you belong to. So a lot of people really want belonging and community. And so the choice is around either staying with that community, or it's a bigger move when you kind of move outside of that, kind of the choices that have been made for you and to make a choice. And that's a smaller group of people.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So a brand relieves you of the burden of choice, right? Once you've made it, you can stick with it.
Yep. It relieves you of that. And you think, and also if it just resonates with you, then it's sending a signal, and it also makes you feel more like yourself. So it's like you look at your medicine cabinet, or I buy very expensive body wash, right? And so just different little things, even if I have a little apartment in New York City, when I was, you know, I'd buy some expensive things and it would help me feel better about myself. Or in lots of instances, it just relieves me of a choice because I trust these brands. And so I don't need to think very hard because they've kind of built in a promise or an expectation. And so they take that burden away from me.
So I like to think about that in terms of humanity and humanism, Grace Anne, and you know, stop me if I'm going too far, but marketing for me was always a very human, as you say, trying to understand people, make them feel good about themselves, make them feel good about their circumstances. The other target that I spent a lot of time on was mom, when working for Procter & Gamble and trying to help her with a household. And we loved mom. We wanted to understand her. We wanted her to love us back. And, you know, there's a genuine kind of affection there. It was real humanity. Is that overdoing it in this day and age, or is it is marketing humanism?
I think it is humanism. I mean, that's why I like what I like about it. People will think, okay, I remember I went to a school and I was speaking at a school about marketing, and they had all these posters around the walls about misinformation and propaganda and how advertising is really bad. And I had to walk through all those posters to give kind of the message to these high school students about the work that I do. But the thing that makes me feel good about it is that a lot of it is about understanding human desire, our yearnings, and basically how do we become the best version of ourselves. So I mean, if you look at taglines and you kind of think about, you know, all some of the great taglines, or people always talk about potential or human potential, or, you know, be your best, be all that you can be, you know, so I think we want to interact with brands that transform us in some kind of way, give us meaning, and then elevate us and transform us into our higher selves. So I love moms. I worked on Huggies. I was on going around the world talking to mothers about Huggies versus Pampers. And it was funny because I was in Israel, and one of the clients in Israel, the whole thing with Huggies against Pampers. Pampers, like, it's about the mom that wants to pamper their child, keep them safe, keep them in a room in a rocking chair, and, you know, nothing's going to kind of hurt them.
Yeah, no risk.
Right? So that was the strategy. And I thought, okay, well, we're Huggies, we're number two, we need to figure out our way in. So I thought, okay, well, there's a different kind of mom out there. There's a, and then Huggies is hugging the baby, kind of like a Nike running shoe, you know? So I put it on this hero brand narrative where it was about kind of getting women out of the house so they could seize the day and embrace the now, and they could, and this brand would help them feel more liberated and free as a mother. And so I presented this to the client in Israel, and there's another woman in the room, she could back me up. And I was telling him about mothers and how some mothers want to stay home and protect their children, but a lot of mothers, they want to get out into the world and also, you know, bring their children with them so they can feel alive and they can take on the day. And Huggies is perfect brand for them. And he said, no. My wife is not like that. You know, that's not, that doesn't resonate. You know, women aren't like that. They want to stay home and protect the babies. And, you know, just kind of had this Pampers mom idea in his head. And I said, well, I think you should go home and talk to your wife. Anyway, but yeah, I think it's human. And they're probably, and there's room for different kinds of moms. They don't all have to be the same, but I do think that mom does exist. And if this brand can help her feel more liberated, more alive, and more ready to take on her day with her baby, and not as isolated from the world. And also the thing was fascinating because we were going to different countries in Asia, the Middle East, you know, Africa, and all these different women were using diapers, and the shifting kind of ideas about motherhood, you could see it from a generational divide standpoint. And part of it was to help some of these women, these mothers, feel okay with being their kind of mom because they couldn't go and talk to their mothers about motherhood advice because they were fundamentally different than the previous generation. So the brand could come in a human way and say, it's okay. You know, you can be and kind of reassure this woman that she's okay. And that we have her back.
Yeah. So, yeah. I always thought Huggies moms were much more fun than Pampers moms. They just let the baby go and whatever happens, happens. The Pampers mom was always worried that if the kid didn't have a 100-word vocabulary by the time it was 15 months old or something. They were very benchmarky, the Pampers mom.
That was the thing, the benchmarks. Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're talking like old people here, Grace Ann, but yeah. I would like to explore this idea that the humanism is lost. I mentioned Kevin Roberts of Saatchi & Saatchi last time we talked. He had this idea that brands are love marks, which I'm not sure whether that ever caught on, but it did capture that idea of this two-way love between the customers and the brands. Is that going too far? Could we think in love mark terms or mutual love? Is that fair?
I mean, I don't know if that's always going to be the primary emotion. So that's where I think maybe it didn't take off because it's not always love. It could be connection. It could be exhilaration. It could be freedom. It could be all these different things. And so maybe you love a brand that gives you that primary emotion that you're looking for, like you talked about with Marlboro, or it could be, you know, again, with younger brands these days, like I worked on Lady Gaga's rebrand. So, you know, and with the emotion, she's very big into love. You know, she wants to love everybody and have them feel love. So that's kind of core emotion that she taps into, but not every brand is tapping into that. I also think brands can own a feeling. And so what is that feeling? It's not always love, but you should feel connected and seen and validated by that brand. And so maybe that will make you love them, but I don't know if it's always love.
Yeah. Okay. But it's an emotion, right? It's a feeling.
I do believe there's an emotion. I think brands do have to carry an emotion to have some kind of power.
Yeah. So I feel sometimes that we're going in the opposite direction now in marketing. We're alienating people. And it was true in the age of advertising. We called it sometimes interrupt and annoy when the television program breaks in the middle and you interrupt and you annoy people with the advertising. But today it seems much more like surveillance and misleading or manipulating. And at least consumers have that sense a little bit. Is that fair? Are we alienating customers sometimes these days?
I mean, I think with the algorithms, I mean, I would say I'm guilty of this. Instagram has figured me out by, you know, the things I like and I think I've just probably bought, and I've talked to lots of women and even men this way, that they kind of get us in a certain way because they're mapping our behavior. So they're just kind of predicting what we might buy. And sometimes I'm like, oh, thank you for showing me that the 25th new yoga brand that I've now shopped in my sleep and bought something, and things show up in the mail that I don't even remember buying.
Right.
So that's kind of where the marketing, right, versus the branding, where they serve you up something to buy. There's a button that you can click really quickly, and they know all your interests and they understand what you're going to click on and what you might buy. So, I mean, you could, and you feel like they're listening to your conversations on your phone because you get served up something. I think I was talking about blackout curtains once, and then all of a sudden I get blackout curtain advertisement. So you could say that's very thoughtful because you know I need blackout curtains, or it's invasive. And is that really tapping into an emotion of mine? Probably not. Is it really working on the branding part? It's more the mechanics of getting something that I have intent to buy at the right moment in the right environment, and then I start clicking on it. So sometimes it's invasive and sometimes it's helpful.
Yeah, there's a danger though of leaning too much towards invasion. It doesn't ask you your permission to send you that ad for blackout curtains. I was talking to a HR executive the other day, and they were talking about how a lot of HR functions are now automated. I can send you a notice on your phone that says you haven't sent in your expense account yet. And it appears from nowhere, and it didn't ask you permission, and it's interruptive and all of those kinds of things. It causes stress and, as I said, a little bit of alienation. So I think that's a danger.
I stopped posting on Instagram. Again, I think because it didn't want to work for Mark Zuckerberg. So I think that is kind of the attention economy, and how the only kind of non-renewable resource we have is our time and our attention and our energy. So that's the part where I feel like if they're robbing us of our life force energy or of precious minutes of time, then using us as kind of their worker bees to build out all the content with only like top 1% actually making any money off that content that they're creating, then that's where I feel like, is the value equation actually working for consumers in this new world in terms of how we're operating?
A quick note. Economics for Business is a uniquely Austrian platform to help entrepreneurs build value-generating businesses at every stage of the entrepreneurial journey. We've now launched online with an outstanding database of entrepreneurial knowledge, tools to solve specific business problems, and a community exchange to share information and experiences. Check it out at econforbusiness.com. That's econ4business.com. Explore and let us know what works best for you in the feedback section. Now, back to our conversation.
So we believe in methods and approaches. There are better ways of doing things. And I was at your site the other day, and I'm going to call your method of brand building, it's about deep, it's depth, it's got real depth to it. I'm going to say you dig and dig and dig and remove all the clay and detritus around a firm and its products to find the core or the essence. I don't know if that's a good way to say it, but can you describe that methodology of getting to the core meaning of the brand?
Yeah, my methodology is more like the Jungian psychology, or putting brands and businesses on the couch. And so a lot of people, when they go through my process, they feel like they've been psychoanalyzed and that they've been seen and they've been heard. And now they truly understand themselves in a way that they hadn't understood themselves before. So a lot of what I do is getting to that authenticity, because a lot of brands, and going back to the origination story. So how did you start? Why do you even exist in the first place? Because there's usually codes and some kind of magic in terms of understanding if you go all the way back to the beginning. So that's one thing that I do. And then I also show them how they're operating off of and do a lot of work. I studied with this archetypal guru, Stephen Fisher. And so I do a lot of archetypal analysis, which, you know, based on Jungian psychology, and I'll show them how they've been operating off of three different archetypal territories a lot of times. This is how you show up this way. You're kind of playing into one emotion, and this is your role, and this is how you're operating and how people are relating to you. And then you might show up a different way here and a different way here. And so I kind of help them, you know, find the most authentic lane to be in. Not that we can't be diverse brands and we can have, you know, dimension to us, but the depth usually comes from something being core and simple and distilled down to your core truth. And then you operate from that core truth, and you can express yourself in with much more clarity, and you're going to connect with the audience better. So that's kind of what I mean by the deep work, but a lot of it's removing other things. I worked, you know, in a lot of brands when they try to become cool when the market has changed in some kind of way. When I worked on Bass Ale, which is like an old beer brand from England, and they didn't know, they were trying to be cool to all the microbreweries, and they just changed their whole entire advertising approach. And it was just completely off, and it flopped horribly. And I said, let's just go back to the basics and figure out who you really are. And you're not going to attract people by putting on a different outfit and pretending you're someone you're not. So getting to that kind of core and putting aside kind of trying to pretend you're someone that you're not, which a lot of brands do. It's like, if I just talk this way, or, you know, change the imagery or change the message in some way, maybe I'll be appealing to the audience. And so a lot of the stuff I do is just get them to stop doing that. I always say, if you're in high school and then you're the nerdy guy in high school, and you're trying to get this hot girl, and she's dating, she's thinking about you, and she's also, you know, she's the football quarterback. You're not going to turn into like her, the guy of her dreams, by trying out for the football team, drinking a bunch of protein shakes, trying to, you know, gain weight, and you're going to get slaughtered on the football field. You're not going to win that way. You're going to appeal to her by, you know, maybe you could be her homework mate, and you're really brilliant and you help her get straight A's, or you show the promise you're going to be the next, you know, internet cajillionaire, or you have, you know, potential, but you're not going to woo her by being someone you're not. So a lot of brands will do the same thing.
So you help them get to that core, that authenticity. Do you want them just to have one archetype? Is that part of the simple?
I do one archetype, but I'm just saying, if you're like a jester brand, you know, doesn't mean that you can't be smart like a Sage brand, or if you're a Sage brand, doesn't mean you can't be funny. But you're coming from one core character that's understandable. So it's just like if you watch, you know, Seinfeld, you have these characters. The person write, you know, they write the characters, and you figure out all the deep work on the character development. And before you even film your first Seinfeld episode, you know, you're figuring out all these, you know, different characters. And then when there's a scenario that's thrown into the mix, like I lost my cat or something like that, all the characters go and it's like the sitcom actually writes itself. So you just need to know what that character is, and then you can do lots of things within that. You still have range, but you at least know who you are. So a lot of brands just kind of pop around and think they should be one archetype.
There's a lot of talk today about purpose, Grace Anne, deep purpose. Sometimes they talk about, and you know, if you can align everybody who works in the company around the purpose, and you can communicate that to customers. Patagonia is the example that's always used. You are saving the planet. Is that part of your thinking, or is that different, or does it overlap? What do you say?
I mean, it overlaps, because if there's a purpose, then that's something core, and you're not going to have 12,000 bullet points. Well, some people will. I mean, I worked with UPS, and they had their sustainability platform. They had about 56 bullet points around sustainability. I'm like, this is really not going to work. So, but if you clarify your purpose, then that is more central to who you are deep down inside, and it drives you and gives you passion and energy. And people are drawn to people that have passion, energy, and a clear purpose that they can understand.
Yeah. You talk about insights on your site. Mm-hmm. We've talked about insights on the podcast. We define it really as a need, an emotional need of the customer. If you have an insight as to what their need is, you can craft the product and the service and the message around that need. Is that the same thing as you're thinking when you talk about insights?
Mm-hmm. The thing that I think we talked about before, just it's interesting in terms of the way that I would figure out brands and figure out messaging, is that I would go brand first versus consumer first. Mm-hmm. Back when I was brought into account planning, it was a voice of the consumer, and it was, okay, we're going to have this thing called account planning, and it's going to represent the consumer within the equation because they're not represented. So this is the voice of the consumer. And again, back to me being more of a brand, meaning symbols, meaning, you know, authenticity. I come from the brand first, and then knowing who the brand is, then I'll look for shared aligned values and an insight from the consumer, an addressable audience that would fit and be attracted to this brand that has this kind of purpose, meaning, and transformative effect on a consumer. So it's, I align, but I go brand first, consumer second.
Okay. But it's a loop, right? It's from the brand to the consumer, back to the brand again. We like the loop. Start at a different place.
It's okay. Chicken, egg, consumer brand. There's a symbiotic relationship. So you can't really have a chicken without an egg. I guess maybe you could have a chicken without an egg, but
we don't know. We kind of have a loop with that. Yeah. You know, it goes on and on and on. I understand. So how do you know you've got a good insight? That was my question.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think how you know you have a good insight is it's surprisingly obvious.
After a lot of work.
Yeah, you could do a lot of work and then you say, of course, of course that's it. The trick is it needs to be surprising and obvious. So it needs to resonate with everybody. So that's why I like to go to plays or, you know, just good writers. They'll capture something and you're like, the way they articulated it or the way they kind of tapped into something. I think if you want to find a lot of insights, go to some good plays, because I feel like there's a lot of kind of inner sights of human nature, what have you, when it comes to that. But yeah, it needs to be surprisingly obvious. So it has to have a kind of a of course factor, but it has to be fresh and like you hadn't thought of it. But once you hear it, it rings true.
Yeah, I love that. I love those kinds of contrasts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the ways you get there with your customers, it looks like, is workshopping.
Mm-hmm.
So can you reveal any of that process? Can you tell us some secrets or whatever you're prepared to share about workshopping? How does that get you where you want to get to?
I mean, I think with the consumer insight, where I get the most insights is when it's more ethnographic and you're in their environment, in their world. And that's kind of a little bit of a lost art because everything's so digital. And so a lot of brands these days will just kind of look at what did the person click on, or who are the Instagram followers that they're following, or what. There's not really, I don't find that people do as much primary research or ethnographic research, but I find I did these dinner parties where we were trying to sell an $80,000 Volkswagen, which we already knew at the beginning was a bad idea. It was called an Audi, and you just buy an Audi. You're not going to buy an $80,000 Volkswagen, but we had these dinner parties and we recruited people that in markets where they would spend at least 50,000 plus or 60,000 on a car. And then we had them they didn't even know that they were going to anything that was research oriented. Only one person, the key host, would know. And they invited their friends and they all fit like a certain criteria. So we brought in entrepreneurs, people that made their money through being entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. The other group were professionals like accountants, lawyers, bankers, kind of had that. And I can't remember what the third group was, entrepreneurs and professionals. Oh, and then creatives, like the creative class. So people that made money using their creativity. They could be entrepreneurs or whatever, but musicians, artists, you know, songwriters, ad kind of people. And then we'd have them around a table and we'd have this dinner party. And I would just slowly ask some questions and I would figure out, well, how do you all know each other? So you try to get an idea of like shared values and interests, and they would start talking about different things. And or I'd look around their house and say, you know, why did you choose this art? Or, you know, I would look and say their TV is in the living room, or it's hidden and they don't even have a TV. They don't even watch TV. So I'd like pick up on all these like clues of how they live their lives and how they choose their friends. And you'd figure out their values, and there'd be an insight in there somewhere by just getting to know them as humans versus just saying, you know, hello person, here's an $80,000, you know, car from Volkswagen. You know, what do you think? Would you buy it? And kind of you get into their rational brain. So you have to keep them in suspended in more their emotional, human, social self, and kind of look around their environments, and you can kind of pick up on things, and you'll get more that way versus just coming in cold and trying to get them to answer. Because people, if you ask them a straightforward, rational question, they might give you a rational answer, but that's not really what's going on. You have to get to the irrational truth.
Yeah. I love that technique. What did it say on the invitation? How did you invite them?
Well, we had the host invite them, and they just curated the crowd based on our criteria. So they knew like, oh, this person has this kind of car and they have this kind of job. And so they didn't even know why they were there.
Yeah.
So it was this kind of slow build of getting lost art of getting to know someone.
Yeah.
It was over 3.5 hours, and we had cocktails and we walked around, and I had two other people with me kind of talking to people. And then we'd compare our notes at the end of the day.
Yeah. So I love that. We believe in ethnography, but when you use that word, it sounds like, you know, Jane Addams wandering around with chimpanzees, whereas you've got a dinner party, which is
a dinner party. Yeah. Which is a dinner party conversation.
Yeah.
Right. It was fun. But that was one of my favorite ways to, I like following people around, seeing what their world is like, going to work with them, going home with them, and just spending more time going deeper. And then you can, that's kind of the way where you find more of the insights. And then you can confirm it with quantitative research or do a study based on unearthing some kind of gem, some kind of insight. But I find it hard to unearth a gem just with, you know, traditional left brain initiatives. But I do quantitative research. I call it conversational quant. Yeah. And so I try to ask questions that are more creative that will get underneath something. So one I did, I worked on this global man study, and I was trying to figure out men and their values across generations, across the world. And I would ask questions like, would you rather be a rock star or a sports star? Or would you rather make significantly less money, but you would be the primary breadwinner and your wife would stay at home? Or would you rather make significantly more money and you would stay home with the kids and your wife would work?
Mm-hmm.
So just like fun, interesting, just not your typical questions. And I was trying to figure it out. And different countries would answer that, and different generations would answer that question differently. So like in Latin America, the men, Latin America and Asia, some parts of Asia, India, the Middle East, you know, they would take the pay cut, the older generations, but the younger generations were like in India was like completely flipped. The men were like, fine, you know, my wife can go work and I'll stay at home. And so it just, you know, and then, but Latin American countries, we're a little bit more conservative. Europe was the most, you know, I think in France, you know, all the men would just be happily at any generation, let the women work. So, but yeah, that's an example of just trying to come at it question in a slightly novel way.
Yeah. Yeah. We tried to term that subjective quantification. It's the subjective values of the individual, but you try to figure it out, but it's the same thing. I've always felt that there's far richer, deeper, better information in qualitative research and quantitative research. And mm-hmm. It's hard to convince people of that, as you say, in a left brain world. So then you build a playbook, Grace Anne, which sounds like we're getting into execution now. It's a guide to how we use all of these insights. Can you tell us about playbooks, how to be good at that? What's in a playbook?
A playbook. Well, that's just kind of how do you play your strengths and play as your authentic self. So, and then keeping people on point when they're using it. So it's like, here's your plays, and this is when you're going to be your best self. So this is how you need to operate. This is how you should look visually. These are the codes that you use. I love kind of building in codes to brands. A lot of fashion brands will do that. Like Gucci will have the G's, and they'll have the buckle, and they'll have the stripes, and a lot of fashion brands build in multiple codes. And I think those are symbols and meanings, and it just kind of gets you a richer playground to work with. So I like to build in visual codes, and it's like a crest, I guess. A brand would have a crest, and there's different things going on because sometimes you want to tap into one versus another, and kind of gives you the depth and dimensionality. So, and I think there's visual cues that can hit the subconscious that you work with. So build that into the playbook. And then language that you would use. So you get into the voice and give examples of this is on voice or not on voice, or are we casual? Is it like a, you know, maybe it's like a woman's brand. Are you there? Are you a doctor talking to them? Are you their best friend? Are you a sister? You know, like what is even that kind of relationship and kind of staying in that? That would be in the playbook. So I think it's just staying in your lane and staying out of the shadow. So back to like Carl Jung and your shadow self, it's always helpful to know when you might veer off into your shadow. So you just call that out and help people know when they might be going a little astray, because certain brands can go that way. So you highlight that in the playbook as well. So you give them the guidelines and guardrails, give them kind of their power visually, verbally, in a voice way. And then people can, because now, I mean, I've worked on Jack Daniels, and I think I don't know what the number was, but it was over 100, if not 500 brand authors around the world that were writing on behalf of the Jack Daniels brand. So you need a playbook to get everybody kind of on the same page, literally, with what that brand is about. So you stay on point. And so right now with the fractured media landscape, and even using content creators, influencers that speak on behalf of your brand. And not that it has to be cookie cutter, but you need everybody to understand what your brand's all about. And so you have to have a way of helping all these kind of authors of your brand stay on point. So it's, I think it's even more important now in this fragmented world that we live in.
Does the playbook include tactics like whether to use social media or not? You know, these are right for the brand, or Instagram's better than Facebook for this brand. Do you go that far or not?
Yeah, it can. I mean, it depends on how much you want to pay us. Give you the keys of the kingdom.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is, you know, like I worked with a health tech brand that, I mean, there are two Harvard doctors trying to figure out and reinvent primary care as we know it. So they never really done marketing. They don't know what the tone of voice is. I mean, how do you figure out even what kind of content or how you show up on Instagram, or, you know, where you should be and what you should be talking about and how that works? So I think, especially if you're creating a new model with people that are not marketers, with technology. So yeah, we got into all the detail of what kind of content and who should it come from, where should they be.
Yeah. And you can trace that all back to the archetype. This archetype wouldn't do this. This archetype would do that. Or here's the boundaries, or, you know, here's where the shadow starts. You can do that.
I mean, it's not all archetypal, but that archetype kind of helps keep you in your lane. But then there's more in terms of your character as who you, because that's too much of a blunt instrument. If you just go with the archetype, you really need to know who you are within that realm. So I say like the archetype is, you know, you're in Texas, and then the brand character, are you in Austin or are you in Dallas? It's very different. So you need to get a more fully formed idea of who you are, but the archetype at least gets you into a zone, and then you kind of refine that over time. And I always find good branding and understanding yourself is like a good tending to your garden. So you have to just always be weeding and manicuring and watering and it can get wild and crazy. You always have to be tending to that. So it's like a practice, I guess, in being yourself, just like we are as human beings. Like, do we show up fully, authentically? It's a daily practice to kind of keeping us at our best self.
There's also another term on your site, Grace Ann, called up-leveling, which sounds like if I do get into the weeds, if I can use that analogy, or it gets a bit too wild, I can, I don't know, prune it, improve it, make the flowers bloom better. Is that so? All brands can do that? It's always possible to up-level or rebrand?
I mean, I think you always can up-level your brand. And I always try to just make people look more valuable. So it's just, are you more desirable? Are you worth more money? Are more people drawn to you? And a lot of it is about being really true to who you are, resonating with the culture today, but presenting yourself in a like high fidelity manner. And a lot of people, when they do their branding, they don't think that that really matters. So like I'm working with different venture funds or people that are bringing new brands or new technology to the market. And a lot of times it's an education of like why you'd actually spend money on the brand, but it does give you respect, disproportionate value, and people take you more seriously if you show up a certain way. And so I think there's a lot of room for up-leveling. I mean, I love working on B2B brands because a lot of times they have no clue. They don't think it really matters, but we're all humans at the end of the day. So if they present themselves in a certain way, even though it's working maybe on the subconscious level with some of their customers, they're like, wow, these people seem like they really have their act together, or they're really sharp, because everything communicates. And you can't just say, oh, well, really, that part doesn't matter. No, it does. Everybody's judging people all the time by all those symbols and codes and messages that they might be sending, you know, consciously or unconsciously. And so the up-leveling is just making that sure that's as sharp and as tight as possible.
Yeah, we often suggest to our entrepreneurs there's more opportunity in B2B for exactly the reason you're talking about. Operators tend not to think so much about that emotional connection. And if you do that right, then it's a big opportunity.
Yeah, I help B2B brands become more fashionable and fashion and beauty brands become more meaningful. So I bring depth to the fashion and beauty brands, which don't always have that. And then I bring fashion becoming more fashionable, or, you know, presenting yourself that way for B2B. But the B2B one is, it's fun. It's actually pretty easy and they haven't really thought about it. So it's kind of, the transformation can be dramatic if they start to apply a lot of techniques and the art of branding that a lot of consumer brands already, they know they have to do that. But the B2B brands, if they start doing that, I think it's really satisfying.
Yeah. Well, let's just finish on economics, Grace Ann. We see brands as assets. They're assets that if you make that emotional connection with a customer, the cash flow comes from it. You said earlier that you can raise prices or get premium prices for a brand. Technically, in finance, brands make cash flows better multiple ways. They're longer, they're higher, they're faster, and so on. So we can make the economic case. But do you find that clients understand that they're investable assets in brands, and that they should think of them that way, as capital, as something to invest in and get a return on, or not?
I mean, I think it depends. But I remember I worked for American Family Insurance, and Lisa Yancey, she was the CMO, or she wasn't even the CMO, she was head of marketing. Then she got promoted to CMO, and now she's president of the whole organization. So it's really impressive. But I remember when she was our client and we were coming up with a brand campaign, their sales have been flat for 10 years. And we tapped into this idea of attaching the brand to the American dream. So we had this idea of, you know, your dream is out there, go get it, we'll protect it. And we tapped into this really emotional territory, and they're still on this dream that they protect dreams, and they want you to go after your dreams, and it's very emotional. And the CFO had to write a big check for, you know, Ogilvy to go do the campaign and do all this work. And he was just like, I don't know about this. You know, I don't see the ROI. This doesn't make sense to me. And then we did the campaign, and they started, after 10 years, they started to see everything go up. Our clients all got huge bonuses that year. And then the CFO at their conference in Hawaii said, you know, now I understand the power of brand, that it has like actual financial return. So I think sometimes they need to see it to believe it.
Yep. Getting the CMO and the CFO aligned is a big achievement, I think. So it's a good story. Well, Grace Ann, thanks very much. I'm going to tag this under the heading of "Do branding, not marketing." is that a good line, or
well, I mean, maybe you can make it better? I think you need both, but I'm just saying, if I had to choose, I choose branding, because that's just more. That's back to my authentic highest, my putting my skills and what lights me up and to the highest and best use. So I'm better at branding. So I don't know if it's do branding, not marketing, but I do think that there is a kind of value in both. And it's good to know the difference, and that you need to know the difference between branding and marketing and make sure you pay attention to both. It's not an either or situation. So I don't know what the title would be. I'm just a branding person. That's just me. But I love marketing people if they can figure it out. And I like to partner with them, because you kind of need that side of the equation. I just prefer to stay in my lane.
Good. Well, it's very diplomatic of you. Where should people come and find you, Grace Ann?
Well, they can find me at, so the website is playbook.studio. So www, I guess I don't even know if you need that anymore, playbook.studio. That's probably the best way. Or they can find me on LinkedIn, Grace Ann Bennett, and then message me there, connect with me. And yeah, I'd love to talk to people if they're interested in the economics and the meaning and the value of brands.
We believe it. Grace Ann, thank you very much. We'll put all those links on the site and we'll see if we can send some people to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was an exhilarating and interesting meaningful conversation.
You brought a lot of new thinking to it, so I appreciate that very much.
Economics for Business is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit econforbusiness.com. And for more from Hunter Hastings, visit hunterhastings.com.